You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real-life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
Amy Anderson, co-founder, chief cool bean of the Wild Coffee Marketing Company. I stole that from your website. I just wanted you to know I did actually look through your website.
Well, that's marvelous. Thank you for doing that pre-work.
And I want to steal some of your designs and claim them as my own.
Did you like them?
I love it. It's just really just sort of, it just emerges out of the page and gives one a sense of immediate calm, purposefulness and well-being.
I love it. That was everything I was aiming for.
And the colors
and more.
I've got a bit of an eye for design. I mean, I wear stripes and plaid and I'm proud of it.
As you should be. I'm the boring black. You can take the girl out of New York City, but it's hard for me to give up all the black.
Well, I've got my Adrian Belew, or Belew, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, my t-shirt, which is my t-shirt that I wear when I try to look cool.
How's that going? Adrian, I think it's going great.
He's sort of in his mid-60s, although he is a fabulous musician and no one's ever heard of him. But the people that have heard of him can join my club of cool.
I love it.
So where did you get the name Wild Coffee Marketing? Is it because coffee makes you wild or?
It does sometimes, but believe it or not, it is a plant that was growing outside of my window in Miami when I was developing my business plan.
The Wild Coffee Marketing Plant.
The Wild Coffee Plant is this really vibrant, sort of fast-growing plant that has to be cut back with a machete. And I said, what an amazing sort of metaphor for this company. And that's what we do for other firms and help
without
them
grow. The machete, presumably. You don't all go to your meetings with machetes in the back, your
I
back
should
pocket.
Just hang them.
In case we get out of control here, just use this machete on us.
Yes, or my team. And we've actually run the company on Zoom for 3.5 years. So we were very ahead of our time with COVID. Started in Miami and we have employees all over, but I'm obsessed with this plant. You can't drink it. It's sort of bland, but it works in terms of just sort of stopping power and describing the energy that's me and the company and my co-founder, Solomon. So it works.
It's funny. One of my buddies runs a company. He's this fabulous musician and his group was called the Wild Ginger Group or something, but he had red hair and I thought it was because of that. But in fact, no, Wild Ginger is part of the Wild Coffee. It's amazing to see your background is Calvin Klein and New York and skyscrapers. And did you move to Miami or did you?
I escaped to Miami, I think.
Yes.
It was back in 2001. So right after 9/11, we sort of got out and decided to try to make life work in the tropics. And it was interesting because back then, Miami was mostly Latin American outposts of big corporations.
Yes. Yeah.
So I was in financial services and ran a team of 20 for a while. And then I decided I wanted to go out on my own and really sort of benefit companies, many at the same time, and try this consulting gig. So
I suppose, I mean, because you worked at the New York Times for a bit. I mean, was that ancient history or was that stuff that still sticks with you today in terms of what you learned with some of these big brands?
Well, what was interesting, it was 1995, so I am aging and dating myself.
Don't worry, no one's listening.
And we were part of the group that launched nytimes.com. So we were New York Times Digital inside of the larger newspaper group. And so we were figuring everything out for the first time. Were we going to capitalize subscription rates? The rest of the paper saw us, speaking of redheads, right, as the redheaded stepchild, they used to call us. And it was just a time of figuring everything out for the first time in journalism and in media. And it was so exciting. And I have carried a lot of that forward because just figuring out, should you gate content? That was one of the first media companies that required registration.
Yes.
To view the content. Now it's paid. I mean, they sort of set the stage for that back then.
But I guess if you've been brought up with this concept of content, quality, brands, you know, marketing is one of those strange animals that is, you know, vital, but you don't know it. And in my experience, most small business owners, and in fact, many C-level executives within the bigger companies, they sort of think, well, marketing, isn't that where you come up with a logo or a slogan or something? I mean, do you come across that? Tell me a bit about the people that you work with.
Well, we're sort of industry agnostic. So we do business to business. We do business to consumer. Carolina Skiff, the largest boat manufacturer of boats in the US under 30 feet, is one of our bigger clients.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, they have a production line that it's hard to get access to materials right now. And with COVID, boat sales went through the roof. They can't make them fast enough, which has been really incredible ride to be on with them. Financial services, software, and telecom. Yeah. But you know, materials are hard to get your hands on right now. Things
there's
like
gonna
aluminum.
There's going to be more puns about the boats coming, by the way. So they're going to be awful, all of them.
I am prepared, you know. But
don't let it sink you, though.
There you go.
Sorry. I'll cut all this out in the edits, I promise. I know, you're just going to kill you. You know, you can leave now.
One of the things we learned is that if there are CEOs, COOs, executive teams who don't believe in marketing, right? So they bring us on because they say, you know, we need this growth strategy and we want to expand and we're in this acceleration mode, but we don't really understand what marketing is and we don't value it. We can do the best work in the world and I can't change their minds. And that has happened because even they'll look at it and they'll say, well, what is this amazing strategy for? I don't even really get it. So you can't teach that to executives. They have to really buy in before you work with them.
And I was talking to someone about this, I think literally just a few days ago, about how marketing is really about perspective and communication. And where this guy, incredibly talented guy, starts is really, you know, with the message. Because what tends to happen is, and again, this is my tiny mind trying to articulate a vast universe of knowledge, but it's where companies start somewhere and grow and kind of don't really know who they are, and then try and layer on top of that a marketing and sales and customer acquisition strategy, further exacerbating that lack of knowledge. And so do you try and bring them back and say, well, let's try and figure out who you are to start with? And one example that he gave, I'm going to do all the talking in this interview.
I love this.
Yes, and provide zero value. But one of the examples he had was he got like three CEOs or three C-level executives in the room and said, okay, no conferring, but tell us or tell me what your company stands for. And so they all busy wrote it down and they handed in their bits of paper and they all had three completely different views of what their key, their mission was or their strategy should be. And so do you sort of start by banging your head against the wall with these people saying, do you actually know who you are?
We do.
See, look, there was a question there. See?
Yeah. So no, and that's absolutely where you have to start because that does happen. And I think if many of us walked into a C-suite, the same thing would happen. If you haven't done that initial positioning, understanding where you sit in the market, what's your promise to customers, who you are and what your mission is. I mean, we do elevator pitches. We go deep, deep into positioning in a market. And then you can understand who you're talking to. Then we do interviews with key customers because the reason that most executives think why people buy from you is not actually the reason they do.
And is that a common thread with all of the people that you work with? Do you find that pretty much with every client, they all have that big sort of knowledge gap where they've grown to the point where they've either forgotten who they are or they never knew what they were in the first place?
Right. And then everything, it's almost like, okay, here's a boat analogy, not a pun, but it's being 1 degree off course. And then over time you're on the wrong continent.
Yes.
Right. And then everything is completely disjointed. And when we go in and do an audit, it's sort of all over the place and you can see where they sort of started to get off course. So you have to have that alignment. Then when you're talking to customers, executives can be very myopic, right? These are why we're good. This is what we do. This is why people buy from us. And when you really talk to customers and get in their hearts and minds, it oftentimes is completely different. And that's what you need to play. The value proposition, this is our unique selling proposition or value proposition. Yeah. Oftentimes it's done sort of in a conference room and not in real life.
Yes. Yeah. And at what point do you find yourself coming in to meet your clients? Mm. Is it at the point where the sort of red flags are hoisted? In other words, you know, we're in danger, we're sinking. God, there's another one. Or is it at the point where you're at the very beginning where you've got your sort of savvy entrepreneurs or savvy business owners who say, right, we've got to get the technology done, we've got to get the marketing done, let's bring the experts in so we start. What's the balance there?
Well, people don't usually call us when things are going swimmingly.
Yeah.
You know? So well-funded early stage startups who have an idea of who they are, but they really need to refine it and go to market. One of our clients was just named the startup to watch in Miami. They are an early stage $6 million round. It's very interesting. Mortgages for foreign nationals.
Yeah, that's all they do. Milo or something. I think you wrote about that on your Facebook page.
I did. So you
can actually name them because it is public information.
Yes. So they had a small marketing team and then a lot of freelancers or agencies and a lot that doesn't work.
Yes.
Everyone needs CMO type strategy. And we collaborated with them. They have a really savvy marketing person in house and she needed support. So we developed the strategy and then we have multiple channels happening at once. And in this market, you know that the expertise required to run a marketing team, you need maybe 12 different skill sets and you can't carry that overhead.
Explain.
That's why outsourcing works.
The only reason I asked that is because there is this assumption that to grow our B2C, so let's talk about the direct-to-consumer or business-to-consumer market. You just run some ads. So let's just run some Facebook ads or some ads on Google. But on your side, you're saying, actually, you need to have a multi-discipline approach to this. So explain what you mean by that.
Sure. Well, some of our clients are unique in that they have a direct-to-consumer channel, like Milo does, and they have a business-to-business channel. So they're reaching financial advisors, mortgage brokers, and then going direct-to-consumer, right? Direct-to-consumer market is crowded in a lot of instances, and you have to spend a lot of money to get there. So we're lucky to be able to supplement that from the wholesale side. If you're just talking about an e-commerce business or direct-to-consumer, do you know how to run a referral program? Do you know how to run an influencer strategy? Do you know digital really well? How is your SEO going? And how is your content writing? And how have you optimized your website and done user testing and design? So there's so many disciplines within the discipline of marketing now that it's really hard for medium-sized companies, 40, 50, 60 million in revenue, say, to have their own marketing department because you can't hire 9 people
or
4 different agencies.
Again, the question is, did you hear over and over again, I mean, do I really need all that stuff? Or was that you just trying to sell me multiple things that I don't need? This concept of influencer marketing or SEO, is that really important? And again, after you've sort of torn your hair out and banged your head on the table and tried to explain in smaller words why it is, I mean, do you see that a lot, that sort of lack of knowledge?
Sometimes, but you know, it's interesting because we're not really a traditional agency. We're a true sort of outsourcing firm, and our senior team works as the VP or CMO of maybe 4 companies at once,
okay. Right?
So they're in saying, you know what, we don't recommend this, but these 3 tactics are really important. And this strategy for this channel. So we really partner with them. So we're not sort of upselling. And they know that from the beginning, that we treat their funds like our own, that we go to executive meetings. We sit in the C-suite as consultants. And a lot of our engagements are multiple years together with
these
companies.
That's important because that really indicates a level of responsibility that comes with that. So if you're in, and again, that's what differentiates you from a lot of other companies, I would have thought, is the fact that if you're in there stepping into that role, then the typical consultant is a one-way ticket. I'll give you advice, but it's up to you what you do with it.
Right. They just drop it, right? Yeah. We call that the seagull approach, fly over, drop, and go, right? But then how are you going to implement that? Everyone has a fancy PowerPoint and you've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars. With us, we say, okay, this is a lot. Let's get to know each other. So we'll actually do multiple days of strategy together, and then we'll hand you a plan.
Yeah.
And then if you like us and we think that we can really make an impact on the business, and then you can hire us to implement that and do ongoing strategy. So it's a big trust factor, right? We're not interested in upselling you things you don't need. We don't skim your media budgets. We're not trying to sell you things and have you come to us and ask us why it's not working. We're looking for the holy grail of what levers can we pull to grow the business. And we are going to take risks in there, but we're doing it with you as partners. And so that's why our model, I feel, where most of us are all client side our whole career.
Yes.
We haven't worked at agencies. We haven't done this work. We've been in-house marketing VPs for a better part of our career.
And that gives you the perspective that is missing, I think, in a lot of agencies. A lot of agencies are sort of, again, working with that. You're sort of pushing data or information, but without that responsibility to actually turn it into action.
Yes. Or you're only as good as an agency as your marketing lead on the client side, right? So if they're not setting you up for success or giving you strategy that works, we have control over the strategy, right? So we're doing the strategy and then the implementation. So it's sort of a dual model that we find works really well. And it's why we're with our clients for a long time. And we have a lot of fun. Matthew, I couldn't imagine going into a situation where I'm working on one brand anymore. Maybe it's my ADD. Maybe it's my energy level. Well, no, I just couldn't imagine it.
But again, do you find that there's commonality within multiple brands? And obviously they have different brands, different products, have different markets and different audiences. But are there themes and commonalities that you've discovered that allows you to provide insight where other agencies or other people that don't have that experience would not be able to?
I think so, because we're in pretty deep, right? So something, for example, like customer data, where does it sit? How is it tagged? How is it used? How do you communicate with your customers? When do you upsell? How do you upsell? Sort of frequency, cadence, all of those things. We'll actually take experience from the boat builder, right? From Carolina Skiff, who has worked with dealers and direct to consumer. And we're applying that, some of those learnings, to the formal wear business.
Yeah.
Actually, it's an investment firm out of the UK that bought 90 tuxedo rental stores in the middle quarter of the US. They're rolling it up into one brand.
Yeah.
And there are things that we're using for multi-location, multiple dealers that we're using for formal wear that we're using for another client also called Stretch Zone. And we are their outsourced marketing team for them. And they have more than 100 locations nationwide. And so multiple locations with a B2B plus B2C channel is where we really sort of thrive. And it doesn't matter if it's boats, stretching, or tuxedos. A lot, we're able to sort of cross-reference industries with clients.
And you mentioned earlier on that you've been on sort of working remotely or working via Zoom for 3.5 years. So COVID comes along 18 months ago, and really now everyone's on Zoom. Now, have you found that that comfort with dealing with people over a call rather than having to meet up for coffee, excuse the pun, is really helping your business?
I think so, because people don't value physical proximity like they did, right? People are saying, well, you're not in my market. How can you be my CMO if you're not sitting here physically? Now, no one's sitting there, right? So it's allowed us to expand our client base up into New York, the West Coast, because they don't feel that they need me driving around or getting on an airplane to come spend time with them. I was on the road a lot.
And I can imagine that, because there is this feeling that if you are our CMO, then you have to come to meetings. We need to see you. You need to physically be there, because we might have some ideas we want to kick around. But that, I think, has all changed. I think that it's necessity being the mother of invention to a certain extent. So do you find that you're now, all those people that you spoke to saying, I don't actually need to be there, now they're saying, oh, I get it. And is that the trigger for growth in your side? So now do you see your type of model, is that something where you're now seeing, because of COVID and because of that change of approach, is that now much more exciting for you?
Absolutely, because I don't know that people want to hire whole marketing teams, or they can, to address the skill sets, to have that sort of commitment and overhead, right? You have six people sitting in an office and then they're remote and you have to manage them. With us, you know we're going to be accountable. With an outsourced team, we have that extra edge, because we know that we want to keep our clients engaged and we want to keep these engagements going. And so we fight really hard to produce results, to be accountable, to always be engaged in ideation, right? And I think there's some complacency sometimes with full-time teams that we have to fight a little harder.
But also, I think this sort of concept of full-time, you've got to really, the benefit that you have is that you're so connected to so many other ideas and businesses. There has to be this sort of overlap where, again, you mentioned from one client, you're not competing, but you're using things, innovation that comes from one industry and you're applying it to another, which you probably wouldn't get if you had an incumbent CMO who's just seeing the same sort of four walls every day of the week.
Right. And we always have to be learning, because if we're not, imagine if clients are coming to us and saying, what about this new platform? Or what if we integrate chat in these ways and it didn't come from us? Like, there's some real shame there. So we're always learning. My team is phenomenal with that, always getting new certifications and looking at different platforms and ways that we can help our clients. So that's amazing. But I have found it challenging, since I can't be in person, to be fabulous on a small square on a screen, right? Yeah. I'm presenting creative, I'm presenting strategy.
I think that's particularly when you're delivering creatives, it's the grand unveiling, isn't it? It's the reveal. So trying to do that if someone's walking around with their mobile phone in their hand.
Yes. I did a presentation yesterday. Actually, we're at the early edge of this market, and I'm so excited. It's a client. They're installing supercharging stations in gas stations throughout the US, right? To build out the charging network for EVs. They're at the early end of this market. And what they thought they wanted, right? They gave us this very bright and cheerful brand that they had developed. And then they said, build something futuristic from that, right? So sometimes clients give you a set of assets and think that they want something, but their brand lends itself to something really cheery and bright and friendly. And that's not what they want to be. So I had to convince them that we were going to depart from their brand. They were going to have to create some extra work, but we were going to go in this really edgy direction. And to do that on Zoom is challenging, yeah. right? Sometimes I wear big earrings trying to keep people's attention.
You know, those sort of those big gloves that have those sort of big fingers. So you just
a foam finger.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't thought about that, Matthew.
Yeah, you just point to the bit in the middle of the screen where your presentation is, you know.
Now I'm turning into a human mouse.
Yeah, or you could get people to wire people up remotely so they get electrocuted.
You know. Right. But I mean, have you been in that situation where you're trying to really sort of keep people's attention and present your ideas? And then
yeah, what the issue is, I think you develop this sixth sense where you watch where people's eyes are, because you can't hear the tapping of a keyboard necessarily. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking to people and they're nodding and you know that they're actually sending an email to their mother-in-law or something, or they're tapping away, they're sort of checking their E-Trade account. And you look, come on, you know, I'm trying to do this reveal here. You right. know, it's a bit like fast forwarding to the end of a video to see how everyone dies.
Right.
And then, you know, reversing back. But with all of this experience and in this new age that I think is not going away, which I think is actually one of the few good things that came out of the pandemic. So are there nuggets of things that you come across again and again when you meet people? If you were ever going to write a book, if I'm ever going to finish a sentence, would you write these down, say, the top 10 things that people need to understand about marketing? Have you got one or two of those you could casually drop in?
Sure. Well, I think you hit on it when you asked this question about really understanding who you are. It's very basic, right? Like, who are you? Who are you talking to? And what are you going to say? I mean, it really boils down to those fundamentals. I think people start diving into tactics and they start building things and campaigns and writing things, but they haven't really figured out who they are and what they're going to say to whom. And then when you start to really focus on those fundamentals and get those in order, then it provides sort of a foundation to build on. But you would be shocked at how many people just go in and do without having answered those basic questions. I mean,
is that because they're not actually solving a problem? How many people do you turn down where you do some research and you say, look, it sounds good, but we can't work with you because you're not doing anything of any use to anyone on the planet?
Well, sometimes it's somewhat useful, but they don't have the budget. You can't just build things and expect you're going to go viral on TikTok in 2 weeks and all of a sudden you're going to have a customer base, right? Or that if you build this phenomenal website and you start posting on social media and you have this really interesting campaign, that all of a sudden you're just going to generate followers because you exist, right? So that's something we have to really manage expectations, that it has to be a budgeted sort of multi-pronged, sophisticated approach to going to market and building customers. It's not often you just build things and then you have demand right there.
There's this great cartoon that my social media manager sent me the other day, which is, I think it was a Garfield cartoon. The bottom line is you have to be everywhere. You can't just be on one platform. Is there any truth, do you think, in this concept that you have to build social credibility? You can't just launch. People believe in you if you've been there a while. Is that important, this sort of longevity, the fact that you've been active for a few months or a couple of years? How important is that?
Sure, time is as important as social, what we call social proof. Right? Are people talking about you? Are people following you? Are people using your product? What are they saying about it? I think reviews matter. That's a form of social proof. Press matters.
Yeah.
You know, where are people talking about you? And I think people use, especially in a business-to-business environment, right? People use social media to really vet you. Are you active? Are you publishing? Are you saying anything interesting? Do people seem to like you?
Yeah.
I think that's how people really use that. And you can't go dark. And that's a real challenge for businesses, right? Like, who would have thought that a private mortgage lender has to be a publisher?
Well,
but businesses have had to turn into that.
You're right, because if you check out someone's Facebook page, because it's so easy to do that, and if you see that the last time they wrote anything was in 1954, you know, does that, even though they're out there, that they're the new up and coming blockchain powered whatever, you know, all the local buzzwords, but if they're not active, is that important?
I think so. It looks like the lights are on and no one's home, sort of thing. And then are you being interesting, right? People don't want you to just be selling yourself all the time. Social media is really not about advertising or talking about yourself. It's about being useful, helpful, entertaining, interesting. We educate clients about that. We love video. I just hired,
two things, interesting and video. So again, we were having a chat the other day and he talked about Steakums. Have you?
I haven't thought about those since the '70s.
Yeah, but say Steakums, which again, you know, is frozen beef sheets. You know, ta-da! But their marketing on Twitter is just a joy. It's funny. It's engaging. It's self-deprecating. It's educational. It's timely. It's informed. And at the bottom, it says, "Oh, by the way, go and buy some beef sheets." Exactly. You know, so it is this,
and it's hard to do. Right? Yes. How often do we see, like, I think some of the social media teams at Wendy's are phenomenal. It's hard to do it right. To infuse humor, I mean, who can't find things that are funny about beef sheets? I mean, I think I'm going to dream about them tonight.
That's right. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, there should be a caveat.
It's hard to do it right, Matthew, right? Like, how much humor can you inject without being too irreverent for a brand, right?
Yeah.
So you sort of have to find that link because it can go terribly wrong.
And the second thing you said, which is video, because again, there is this common thread that one thing sort of leads on to the other, in the sense that if you keep trying to drive a message home, like you're bashing someone over the head with a baseball bat over and over again saying, buy our stuff, people just don't want to read that stuff anymore. But is there a resurgence of, one of the guys that I interviewed the other day is a guy that set up a company called BombBomb. And what they have said over the last few years is, look, you've got to deliver messages through video. People, let's rehumanize. So is that what you're coming across as well, this concept that people don't want carefully crafted content? They want to know who is on the other end of the phone.
I mean, I really think that authenticity and transparency is one of the biggest trends that we're seeing, that it's sort of taking the veneer off. We've all had it ripped off unwittingly, right? In the last year and a half, nobody really trusts, I think, a lot of the high gloss stuff.
Yeah.
We expect that even from Nike, showing vulnerable athletes in many ways, or the conversations we're having around mental health and athletes. I don't think people want you to try to pretend to be something to sell you something. I think they want you to be authentic and genuine and say, look, this is who we are. We're the people behind it. This is what we developed. We think it might meet a need of yours. And if it does, great. Like, let us help you.
It's the removal of the veneer. But the one thing I hate is this faux vulnerability.
Tell me about that.
Which is where people will start writing intensely personal stuff about themselves with a view to try and create this effect that they are being vulnerable, when in fact, all it makes you want to do is actually reach for the bin so that you can vomit into it. Because there's that sort of, do you remember greenwashing, where companies would pretend to be environmentally conscientious? And they'd say that we're saving the world, we're contributing to we're growing trees on the back of penguins or something, so buy our stuff. There's that sort of, my pet hate is this sort of people or companies trying to appear to be vulnerable, in inverted commas, when it's just part of this fake strategy. So,
right. And I think people really see through that, right? If it's not authentic in its intention, then it will not work. It's the same thing with using humor. You have to be very careful. Trying like faux vulnerability to show that you're real will not work unless it's authentic in its intention, right? Even people, like, Pride Month comes. And I believe you don't capitalize on that symbol, the meaning, the colors, unless you are genuinely supporting that community.
That's what I mean. It's that same thing. It's leveraging.
Back.
The equivalent is stolen valor. It's that thing. It's appropriating constructs from other things. I can't think of the word. I'll insert it later and appear clever.
Use a woman's voice, please, when you do it. It'll make it more interesting. I meant to mention this before. You mentioned your social media person and manager that you work with. I find that journalists or people with journalism backgrounds make really talented social media professionals. I think that we have all learned that you cannot hire a young kid out of college to work on a brand because they're good at social media. It requires really authentic storytelling capabilities, understanding different voices, understanding a market really well. And I have hired some journalists in the company who are wildly talented, and they tell really good stories and they really get a market. They really get people and can engage really well. They're some of your most important hires because what they do is very visible and they require a great bit of talent and experience, especially if you're working across multiple markets, right?
That is really insightful, actually, because that leads on to the discussion. Is it content that makes ads work, or is it delivery and audience selection? Mm-hmm. So your sort of data-driven approach is to say, well, let's segment this market. Let's look at what demographics we believe, and then let's target that. Does that get better results than let's focus on the content and the message and what we're actually trying to say, and hope that that resonates with people that want to listen? So there's
those. Right. Well, I think it's the connection, right? It's that authentic connection you're trying to make. I mean, think about like the scrolling and the speed of the scroll and the attention span now. How can you connect with someone in a really short period of time to potentially identify a need they may have?
I got an email this morning, which is the first email I actually stopped and read. And it was from someone who had taken the time to, in three sentences, prove that he'd actually read something about us. And I will get back to him just to say, I'm sorry, we can't work with you, but I just want to say what a brilliant email and thank you for taking the time. So I now feel obliged, finally, to actually speak to someone who's approached me cold calling and not deleted it.
And it wasn't about design. It was just the connection he made or she made by showing you that you were worth the research and that there was some thought put into that. And I think that that matters. It's a perfect example. You didn't do it because, I mean, I really like Lyft and Uber emails and their use of color and a lot of the sort of blocking they do and images. But it's the ones like that, that somebody took the time and connected with you. That makes sense.
I mean, I think that stuff really works. It sounds like you agree that the stuff that works is where you don't say, let me introduce myself. We are, and then reams and reams of homework that I have to sort of pile through. That simple message, the short one line or two line email, I've done my research. I know who you are. I've seen some of the stuff. Here are some numbers. You did this. You said that. You raised this. You partnered with this company. I'd love to work with you. Don't worry if we can't, but here's my number if we can.
Exactly. Are we a good fit based on these things that I know about you, right? So that's where the myopia comes in, where people think that companies and brands think that they need to talk and talk and talk and prove. I don't think you need to say that much to connect or to identify a potential need, right? And in the business-to-business environment, we really just like text-based emails a lot of times that we'll give to people and to say, hey, this is who we are. And does this sound like a good fit to you?
And you're right. So it is. Less is more, isn't it? And I found that to be the most successful approach. They're so tempting to try and throw in graphics and images and links and, you know, look, you know, here, bucket full of stuff. It's the equivalent of the needle in the haystack.
Right. So people have to sit and decipher. And actually, it's funny. I saw some first pass of some work today and from my team. And I was like, oh, these are great marketing emails, more sort of top of the funnel. When someone's in a consideration phase, you're needing to break through or just to show who we are. I said, but when things are more transactionally oriented, please don't make them do the work, right? Yeah. Just do this for them, make it really simple for them. So that user experience, right, comes in design and copy and layout and even execution to really make things easy on whoever is working with you or might do business with you.
And again, these are things that are counterintuitive in the sense that you feel like you should have to justify yourself by proving that you have images and you have links. Which means that, coming back to what you were saying earlier, you lose that authenticity, that connection.
It's almost like showing off. You don't have to show off your marketing chops all the time. I know visual, it's fun to present and you think you're doing the right thing, but really put yourself in the shoes of the user. Like when you open that email today, you're like, oh God, not another one. And somebody else sort of hitting me up to do business. But wow, maybe we're not a good fit, but thanks for taking the time to try to get to know me, to show what kind of person you might be to do business with. You know,
and being able to create that sort of content and that message is a skill, an industry. It is a world unto itself, which you occupy and you're an expert in. So I think that is the message. Look, you're great at building stuff or plumbing stuff or designing stuff, let us help you communicate that, because you can't be good at both things. You just can't, because your brain's not big enough.
So. No. You know, our favorite clients are ones that say, you know what? I know where I'm trying to take this company. We had this concept, or we have a legacy business we've had in our for 50 years, but we don't know that much about marketing.
Yes.
And we really trust you. And we believe in the strategy that you developed for us. And we know that you're tracking 5 KPIs every month, or 7, right? So that we can show, how are we doing? We give good news at the beginning of every meeting. Hopefully it's good, right? So sometimes market conditions change, or we try something that doesn't work, but we really data-driven.
You've
decision.
Got data, exactly. Yeah.
We have to, right? That's our survival. We're a cost center, right? So when you're doing business development, it's a different story. But as marketers, I mean, since I was 21 years old, I've had to prove my value. Now we have to do it exponentially as consultants. And I think that's what keeps us on top of our game.
Yeah.
Right. I don't have a cush job where I can sit and stay for many years. It's not how it works.
That's why I would always, wherever I can, work with people that are like you, where your motivation is very different than it would be if you were on a salary, because at that point it's natural for you to sort of sit back because you've got that money coming in or you've got that comfort. But if you're in your position where you're only as good as your last deal, effectively, is that I don't mean that disrespectfully, but
no,
you know.
It's true. And I'm mentoring some high school entrepreneurship students and some collegiate level ones right now here in South Florida. And one of the things that I talk to them about is that entrepreneurship is a mindset. You can work in a big company and be entrepreneurial, right? Finding a better way, yes. Problem solving, thinking out of the box. But I think that in the environment in which I work and my team works is we have a fire, right? Because we are only as good as our last deal, our last campaign. And it creates a motivation and sort of a sense of urgency also to be efficient and to work effectively and quickly, right? Things can't take a long time because clients need them. And then we use too much capacity of the firm's time on one client and we can't work on other things. So we move very, very quickly.
For any company, doesn't matter what the size, if you don't have that core marketing capability in-house, then the only logical approach is to outsource it and not to try and build a team. Because if you bring the wrong person in at the top, then it's just going to be sort of chaos underneath. So,
right. So I identify people with commitment issues at the executive level.
Yes.
So, you know, I said, why would, that's a big commitment to make to a CMO and a team, and you're paying their health insurance and supporting their families. And when it's not working with us, we can put different people on it. We can pivot really quickly when we don't lock people into agreements.
The conversation is different because you have a different conversation with someone where you have that contractual relationship where it's like, okay, this isn't working, fix it. If it's someone who's an employee, it's like you've got to approach it differently because there are different rules around what you have to do and how you have to approach with, you know, employees. So you've got a lot more freedom as a company owner to get the results that you want by working with people like you.
Exactly. You know where that really is tough with design. When companies are sort of interviewing us and talking to us, because it is much like a job interview, right? You can't get a pitch meeting for me and then sign me on as your CMO.
Yeah.
Like you really have to get to know me a little bit. My business partner, who I've been with off and on for 17 years in a work perspective, he and I have worked together for that long. You have to get to know us and decide, do I like them and trust them? So it is a little bit like that, but design is very tough. And when we're in this interview process with potential clients, when I see an in-house designer, I'm like, oh, that whole brand is shackled by one person who's your employee that you have to treat in a way when you're giving feedback, which is tough with design, right?
Yes.
If they didn't hit the mark.
Yeah.
So that's a really tough position to have in-house, we see.
It is, because again, if the design is bad, and we've been through this process before where you start with something, you're just not hitting the mark.
No. And you can't art direct your way out of it either. Like when something really misses the mark, you have to scrap it.
Yeah, you can't. Otherwise, you're polishing the proverbial, you know. So
yes, exactly.
Or putting lipstick
on a pig.
Yeah.
Yes.
But now, Amy, I have in my hand. All of that was just a precursor to this. I have some questions here for you.
You do.
I have the Hooked on Startups quick fire questionnaire.
Love
it. Amy Anderson, are you ready? Fasten your safety belt. Scream if you want to go faster.
I'm ready.
Question number one. What is your favorite word?
Ebullient.
Oh, most excellent.
It just is fun to say. It's great in the mouth. It means the most joyful of the joy. And I've loved it since high school when I discovered it.
It is fantastic. That is so far my favorite answer.
I love it.
Question number two, what is your least favorite word?
Moist, for all the reasons.
Do you know, it's another, you're the second person to say that. It's a word that just has too many vowels and...
just too many things and the whole thing. And actually, my teenagers hate that word. So maybe that's something that's coming from all of them. They all hate moist.
Yeah, I think it's the way it's constructed is that sort of just badly made.
Yes.
Question three, what are you most excited about right now?
I am so excited with where my business is going and sort of emerging out of COVID and seeing all the good people doing all the good things and the opportunities that are coming out and finding the silver linings during a time that's been really hard on a lot of people. I'm seeing a lot of good right now, and that's exciting.
I know what you mean. And question four, what turns you off right now?
People who are absolute in their opinions and are not willing to listen to anything else. So sort of that confirmation bias that we see happening all around us all the time is really hard.
I'm sure. And number five, what sound or noise do you love?
As a Florida girl, it has to be the waves.
And number six,
to be, and we don't have big ones here, but I'll still take them. Waves
just,
are big.
I know that. Just the gentle wash, the irregular regularity of it.
Yes, even the crashing ones, that's fine. Crashing's fine.
My next question, so what sound or noise do you hate?
A different kind of crashing. People who drop weights really hard at the gym.
Yes.
Why do they do that? Why is that necessary?
Together with the grunting.
Just the whole thing. Why? Just put them down. Don't drop them. Don't throw them.
No, but it's the punctuation. It's the period, isn't it? I have lifted 100 pounds, crash.
There you are. It's the statement I didn't need to hear. Yes.
Maybe it's just a demonstration of gravity.
Yeah, maybe. Look, gravity. Maybe they're doing perpetual science experiments and not just trying to show off that they lifted very heavy.
Maybe it's just a conversion of kinetic energy into sound.
Exactly. And I'm like, sir, we're in Orange Theory fitness.
That's right. Yes. Well, I did bring my own weights. Yes. This is where the guy actually brings his own weights to Orange Theory just so he can make the crashing noise.
I'm like, we're under soft orange lighting. We're all friends here. There's no crashing of weights. I don't understand.
He's in a tank top with his
like Ron Jim. That's the CrossFit box down the street, not here.
Yeah. No, God. Well, thankfully, I don't go to any of those. far too expensive. I worked out it cost me on average of about $2,000 per visit.
yes. By the time you amortized your membership.
Yeah. So by the time you have the membership and the number of visits, $2,000.
And that's that fear and that efficiency I need with my money that gets me up at 5:30 in the morning. I just find that momentum is really important with life. And so I do, I am an early riser. I believe if I start off productively, it's okay if I taper off in the evenings, but I've got to start.
I know what you mean. I mean, I'm a great fan of the tapering off bit.
Yes. Yeah. With a martini glass.
You know, I like to set myself low standards and consistently fail to achieve. Yes. Moving on to question seven, before I dig myself an even deeper hole. What is your favorite curse word?
Oh, you know, a lot of people will go with the F-bomb, but I really like jackass. I think it's sort of retro. I like how it sounds. I like that it denotes like a mule sort of image. And I just like what a jackass. But it just works for me.
But it can be a powerful word as well, because at the surface, it appears benign.
Right.
But underneath, the true meaning of the word jackass delivers that punch that...
I think so. The F-bomb is very versatile, but jackass is just... I like it.
Know what you mean. I think I might use that one now. And
I think you should. Just not with your family this evening.
It should be
go find another context.
The word jackass. It should be a community, a Facebook.
We should
group.
Bring it back.
Bring back jackass, yeah. Yes. Question number eight. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I would love to teach. I think this entrepreneurship mentoring has been really exciting for me. And I wonder if I'm meant to be a teacher sort of later in life and take all these things that I've learned and get people inspired. And I think, you know, I was a kid of the 80s who loved Dead Poets Society and Robin Williams and really kind of coming into the classroom with panache and making a difference. And I wonder if I could do something like that. So it's something I think about.
Fabulous. And number nine, what profession would you not like to attempt?
Accounting.
Do you know, you're not the first person to say that.
Really?
And it's a black art. It's not because it's dull. It's just, they speak a different language.
They do. And they get really excited about it. And I envy that. And I have really good ones in my team, but let them do all of that and then give me some data to help me make good decisions. I just want the very top layer. I want the icing.
The other side of the coin, we get excited about the metaphysical. They get excited about the absolute because numbers are absolute.
Yes.
But there's perfection in mathematics that...
Right. And I love all of the possibilities of what could be in this beautiful world. Like I live in sort of a different place.
I think it's a left brain, right brain thing, actually.
Yes. Are you left-handed or right-handed?
Mid-handed. I'm actually I'm right-handed, but I'm also a good liar. So if the circumstances are appropriate, I will lie and say I'm left-handed.
Say you're lefty. My business partner and I are both lefties. Isn't that interesting?
But I still don't get what this left brain, right brain thing means. I know that there are two sides to the brain and
I think, and it goes diagonally to one of the things, but you know what? I play golf and I bat righty and I cut with scissors righty. So it's just sort of this weird, I wouldn't consider it ambidextrous. I swing things better on the right-hand side of my body for
just
whatever reason.
Universally talented, I think. My final question then, Amy, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Well done. Open bar to the left.
Fantastic. The best answer award so far goes to Amy Anson.
Thank you very much.
It's been such a pleasure. Final question. How do people find out more about the Wild Coffee Marketing Company? And everything?
We are easy to find. If you just come to wildcoffeemarketing.com, and I'm also on LinkedIn as Amy Anderson and Wild Coffee. I'd love to chat with anyone who thinks that they might benefit from having some outside marketing help. Can be a lot of different kinds of people. So it's really exciting for us.
And I'm sure that both of my listeners will be stampeding.
Thank you to all two of you for being here today.
I know we doubled the numbers last week, actually. I'm just so excited about that.
That's fantastic. Well, you're a great host and interview, and I've really loved being here today.
Thank you so much. Please come back again sometime.
I'd love it.
Look forward to following your progress.
Absolutely.